Welcome to Washington Today for Monday, May 1st, 2023. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Politico and The Washington Post are reporting that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned this afternoon that the U.S. could default as early as June 1st if Congress doesn't act to raise the federal debt limit. Politico writing that, quote, the latest guidance increases pressure on congressional leaders and the White House to strike an elusive deal to raise the debt ceiling. The Washington Post noting that, quote, the new estimate followed less than a week after House Republicans delivered on their pledge to try to leverage the looming deadline to secure spending cuts, defying President Biden and officially touching off a political stalemate that could tip the fragile economy into another recession. Meanwhile, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced the Senate will hold a hearing this week on the Republican debt ceiling bill. The bill passed the House last week and is tied to deep cuts in government spending. And President Biden said the taxpayers are not bailing out a third regional bank that failed over the weekend. He also repeated his calls for Congress to pass legislation to increase penalties on bank executives for bank failures caused by mismanagement, and again for regulators to take additional steps on supervision and liquidity requirements. We'll start there at the White House. Here's more from the president, who was speaking at an event for small businesses.
Regulators have taken action to facilitate the sale of First Republic Bank and ensure that all depositors are protected and the taxpayers are not on the hook. These actions are going to make sure that the banking system is safe and sound, and that includes protecting small businesses across the country who need to make payroll for workers and their small businesses. And so let me be very clear. While depositors are being protected, shareholders are losing their investments. And critically, taxpayers are not the ones that are on the hook, as I said earlier. Now, going forward, I've called on Congress to give regulators the tools to hold bank executives accountable, and I've called on regulators to strengthen regulations and supervision of large and regional banks. And folks, we have to make sure that we're not back in this position again. And I think we're well on our way to be able to make that assurance.
Now, regulators seized First Republic Bank over the weekend and sold most of its assets to JP Morgan Chase. The move comes after First Republic depositors pulled more than $100 million out of the bank in March following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. The California-based lender never really recovered from that. First Republic's failure is expected to cost the Federal Deposit Insurance Fund more than $13 billion. Moving to Capitol Hill, the House is out this week, but the Senate is in. They are working on President Biden's judicial nominations to U.S. Circuit and District Courts. And here's more from Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on this week's Senate consideration of the Republicans' debt ceiling bill.
Senate Democrats cannot and will not allow Republicans' Default on America Act to become law, because the consequences of these cuts for American families would be severe. For generations, Congress has made spending and revenue decisions as part of the annual budget process. That is the appropriate place to debate, not here as a bargaining chip, a take-it-or-leave-it bargaining chip for the hard right. So beginning this week, our Senate committees will do what House Republicans would not do, hold hearings to expose the damage that the cuts contained in the Default on America Act would cause to everyday American families. We'll show the American people how the Default Act would rip away SNAP benefits for over 1 million recipients and eliminate Pell Grants for tens of thousands of student loan borrowers. We'll show the American people how the Default on America Act would raise taxes by over $500 billion over the next decade, crippling job creation, stifling economic growth, and squandering our future prosperity to the benefit of the Chinese Communist Party. And we'll show how the American people how the Default on America Act would cut critical funding to nearly all sectors of American life, leading to fewer jobs, higher costs, and leaving policemen, first responders, Border Patrol, and our brave veterans all hanging out to dry. We cannot move forward so long as hard right MAGA Republicans, which we all know have tremendous, enormous leverage in the House, insist on their bill, a bill that is unacceptable to the Senate and the vast majority of the American people. Sadly, if the hard right continues running the show in the House, the dangers of a first-ever default will keep growing, day by day. And as we expose this terrible bill for what it is, Senate Democrats' position remains the same. The only real solution is for both parties to pass a clean bill to avoid default, with no brinksmanship, no hostage taking.
Part of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's Leader Time remarks on the Senate floor this afternoon, which came before the reports from the Washington Post and Politico that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warning that the U.S. could default as early as June 1st if there is no action by Congress to raise the debt limit. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, he was in Jerusalem today with a bipartisan delegation of 20 members of Congress. He spoke to the Israeli Knesset, and we'll hear a portion of that speech in a few minutes. But he also talked to reporters following his speech and said he is not concerned, or he is concerned about the debt ceiling, but has not heard from President Biden following the House passage of the Republicans' bill last week.
On the debt ceiling, I'm concerned about the debt ceiling. I have been from the moment I became Speaker. That's why on February 1st, I went to see the president and said we should sit down and solve this problem. Look, the debt is a big challenge for America. We're going to have to come together to solve it. We've been through this before. The only way you solve problems is you negotiate. And I'm looking forward to the president changing his mind and negotiating with us. If that's not the case, I wanted to make sure that the debt ceiling did get raised. And so we raised it before we came here. Not only did we raise it, we believe we need to make America stronger, not just in our debt, but in our economy. So we put items in there that would make our economy stronger, especially when it came to energy. We'd also make the global environment better. My friend, or not my friend, this individual from Russia that asked this question, if we simply replaced Russian natural gas in Europe for 1 year, we would lower 218 million tons of CO2 emissions. So not only would we make the environment stronger, we'd make the world safer. God blessed us with the resources, and we should be able to provide it. It'd make the economy stronger. We want to cut red tape so we could build things in America again. We may have difference of opinion on both sides, but if the Senate has a different opinion, pass a bill. How Congress works, if you just go back to Schoolhouse Rock, House pass a bill, Senate pass a bill, they can go to conference, and the president can then decide. But the one thing I do know, Schoolhouse Rock, they never told you not to negotiate. They told you to work together, and that's what we're doing. Yes, sir.
Can I just say something? I just want to, because I think it's important to say, Speaker spoke on Wall Street. And he said that defaulting on our debt is not an option. I think we have universal, or almost universal, agreement on that proposition. And I believe America will not default on its debt.
We will not pass the debt ceiling that just raises it without doing something about our debt.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and we also heard Maryland Democrat Steny Hoyer, who was part of the bipartisan group in Israel today, and reaction from the White House following the speaker's comments. Here's Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Thank you. Two questions. What is the White House view of Speaker McCarthy's visit to Israel, especially given that the issue of judicial overhaul there has not been resolved? And can you also say, I know the president, the speaker and the president haven't spoken about budget issues, but did the White House brief Speaker McCarthy before his trip, or any officials?
I don't have we don't have any readout or engagement to read out at this time. Look, I'm not going to get into the speaker's trip or to Israel. As we know, that is not unusual for a speaker to travel outside of the country, to travel to a country like Israel. We have seen comments that the speaker has made, and so we'll let him speak to his intentions, but I'm not going to dive into the trip more broadly. That's for something for the speaker to speak to.
And here's William Hoagland of the Bipartisan Policy Center. He talked about how he sees this current debt ceiling fight playing out.
This is deja vu in many ways. I've seen this movie before. This one's a little bit more scary from my perspective as opposed The first time I dealt with the debt limit issue was when I was a staff director of the Senate Budget Committee in essentially 1985, and it was brought about by a situation where we were, again, the same situation where we had at this time a Republican in the White House, Mr. Reagan, and a Republican-controlled Senate and a Democratic-controlled House, a little bit flip of where we are today. And we were dealing with an issue of we passed a budget resolution in the Senate. That budget resolution that passed in the Senate passed by one vote, and George W. Bush, the first Bush president, was vice president at the time, and he broke a tie. But this was something that Republicans had put together a budget, and that budget was to, if you can believe it, was to reduce a deficit at that time, which was $200 billion.
Wow.
And we were to reduce it. And long story short, that particular budget went to the House, and it included in the Senate. It was a very controversial budget resolution because it had a one-year freeze on Social Security benefits, and it reduced President Reagan's defense request. What happened was it went to the House, and the House, quite frankly, my boss at that time, Senator Domenici, and Senator Dole were basically undercut by President Reagan, who said he would not support that, and so it came back. And it caused a lot of controversy for Republicans who had put their necks on the line to look at trying to reduce the deficit. That led to the next step, which was there was a movement by Senator Rudman in the Senate, Senator Phil Graham, say, wait a minute, we're going to come up now I guess it was October of 1985, we're going to have to increase the statutory debt limit, same situation, $2 trillion. We're at $31 trillion, $2 trillion. That wasn't that long ago, at 85.
About 35 years ago, the national debt was $2
trillion. $2 trillion. And now we're at 35. And what Senator Graham and Senator Rudman said, we're not going to vote to raise that debt limit, which requires 60 votes, at least in the Senate, unless we have a change in our fiscal policies. And that eventually resulted in this thing called Graham-Rudman-Hollings, which was a kind of a precursor for lots of things that followed in 1990, 1997, and into 2000, where we set caps on spending. And if spending exceeded that cap, there would be what we called, and first time I ever heard the word, I thought it was a Texan word that I never heard about, called sequesters. We would cut spending below that. Graham-Rudman-Hollings won. We can argue it was designed to get to a balanced budget again. We can argue, I don't think it was as successful as people thought, but it did set up a process and bring mechanisms into place that led to the 1990 agreements, and then also, more importantly, with Mr. Clinton, and then 1997, further negotiation. What I'm getting at here is that required negotiations, and I know and I respect the president having essentially worked with him and when he was a senator here. And I respect the process, but I think you have to recognize that we're going to have to negotiate. I'm a little worried about this game of chicken right up to the limit, because it'll have major economic impact, both not only domestically but globally, if the federal government, for the first time in its history, has defaults on paying its bills. That would be a real disaster, both for Republicans and Democrats, I believe.
Bipartisan Policy Center Senior Vice President William Hoagland on today's Washington Journal. You can see the entire discussion at cspan.org/Washington Journal and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. And again, just repeating the news from earlier, Politico and the Washington Post reporting that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned today that the U.S. could default as early as June 1st if Congress doesn't act to raise the debt limit. And one more note from Capitol Hill today. Maryland Democratic Senator Ben Cardin announced he is retiring from his seat next year. The 79-year-old is in his third term in the Senate after serving 20 years in the House. He's currently the chair of the Senate Small Business Committee. Here's part of his announcement video.
I still have work to do. I want to make sure that small businesses are protected in this really challenging environment. We got to take care of the Chesapeake Bay. We're not finished yet. Baltimore City needs some real attention. And I'm in a position to do some things to help in the healthcare arena. I want to make sure that we expand telehealth. I want to make sure we deal with behavioral health and mental health issues. So I still have a lot more work to do during these next 2 years.
But Ben, I think it's time.
It is time. It is time. And when this term ends, it'll be my last years as an elected official. I will not seek re-election. Thank you, Marylanders. Thank you for giving me the opportunity of my life to represent you in the United States Senate. I've given my heart and soul to trying to do my best, and I thank you for giving me that opportunity.
Part of Ben Cardin, the Maryland senator, retirement announcement. We also heard his wife Myra in there. He is the third Senate Democrat to announce retirement this year, following the announcements of Dianne Feinstein of California and Debbie Stabenow of Michigan. Democrats will be defending 23 Senate seats in the 2024 election. Republicans will have 11 seats. Senator Cardin's seat is considered a safe Democratic one. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. The White House has announced that it will end the COVID-19 vaccine requirements for federal employees, federal contractors, and international air travelers at the end of the day on May 11th. That's the same day the public health emergency ends. As part of the announcement, the Departments of Health and Human Services and Homeland Security said they will also end their vaccination requirements for Head Start educators, Medicare-certified healthcare facilities, and certain non-citizens at the land border. In a statement, the White House says, quote, while vaccination remains one of the most important tools in advancing the health and safety of employees and promoting the efficiency of workplaces, we are now in a different phase of our response when these measures are no longer necessary. Earlier today, Kevin McCarthy became just the second House Speaker in history to address Israel's Knesset. He appeared during a two-day trip to the country with a bipartisan congressional delegation. He also met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We'll hear part of Speaker McCarthy's speech coming up. And we're just days away from the official coronation of King Charles III in London. The event will include fewer world leaders and a younger generation of royalty compared with last year's funeral for Queen Elizabeth II. But Britain's first coronation in 70 years is still expected to draw large crowds. We'll hear more about it from best-selling author Tina Brown coming up. The White House said it estimates that Russia has suffered 100,000 casualties over the past 4 months in its ongoing invasion of Ukraine. That number includes more than 20,000 Russian troops killed. And the Associated Press writing today, quote, in what has become a grinding war of attrition, the fiercest battles have been in the eastern Donetsk region, where Russia is struggling to encircle the city of Bakhmut in the face of dogged Ukrainian defense. Here's more from National Security Council spokesman John Kirby responding to a question from Reuters' Steve Holland.
Hey, John, on Ukraine, since the Russians have suffered these casualties, is the time now ripe for this Ukrainian counteroffensive, or what's an update on that?
That's really a decision for President Zelensky to make, Steve. It's his military, and the operations he conducts now and the operations he plans to conduct in the future are really for him and his military commanders to decide. What we want to stay focused on is making sure that we're helping them be as ready as they can be for whenever they choose to step off. And that means, obviously, in material support, and you've seen over the last three, four presidential drawdown packages that we've announced that they are very much focused on ammunition and clearing capabilities to allow them to have what they need to break through Russian defenses. And you're going to see continued packages coming from us very, very soon. And I would also add that based on our discussions with the Ukrainians about the kinds of material they needed for the offensive operations that they want to conduct in the spring, that we have fulfilled nearly everything on that list. Nearly everything. I mean, it's almost 100% complete of everything they've asked for. They've been provided. Now, again, I want to stress, you're going to continue to see support coming from us in coming days and weeks, as I as the president has indicated. It's not only the material, it's the training. You know, we don't talk about it much anymore because it's, you know, it's not front of mind, but we continue to train battalions of Ukrainian forces outside the country in this thing we call combined arms maneuver, because they identified that they needed to be good or better at combined arms maneuver if they want to have success here come late spring, early summer. So it's a combination of making sure they've got the tools, but also that they have the capability to use those tools, the skills to use those tools. And that training has gone very, very well. The Ukrainians have really picked it up quickly and are doing exceptionally well at it. So all that's to say, Steve, a long answer, but they really are, in terms of readiness, they will be ready. And the United States is not alone in helping develop that readiness for them. We have lots of allies and partners who have contributed. But when they decide to step off and where and how they conduct that, again, I certainly wouldn't, even if I knew, we wouldn't get ahead of their future operations, but it's really for them to speak to.
And just to follow up, this figure of 100,000 casualties, which is quite staggering, how did you reach that number?
That is based off of some information and intelligence that we were able to corroborate over a period of some time. And that's really as far as I can get to it. But it is based on some downgraded intelligence that we've been able to collect.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby speaking on a conference call earlier today, and in that Associated Press article, they note that Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Mark Milley said Russia had suffered well over 100,000 killed or wounded in the first 8 months of the war, so that the new figures suggest that Russian losses have dramatically accelerated in recent months. Also at today's State Department briefing, the return of Fox News correspondent Ben Hall. Mr. Hall was seriously hurt last spring while covering the Russian invasion in an attack that also killed Fox News cameraman Pierre Krzyzewski and Ukrainian journalist Alexandra Kuvshinova. Ben Hall's return was marked by veteran AP State Department reporter Matt Lee.
Before I turn it over to Ben for the first question, I just want to say something about his return.
Yeah.
You know, there were quite a lot of words spoken over this weekend in Washington, D.C., about the importance of a free press and the, you know, the role that it plays in informing the world and the American people and others. And I just want to remind everyone that, you know, Ben literally almost paid for this principle with his life. And we're very thankful that he survived and recovered and is back. Back with us here in the briefing room, so it's really good to see you and welcome back. Let me just stand up.
And I just want to say again, I obviously didn't work here when you were in a place to not attend briefings, but I am so glad to be up here to welcome you back. So
well,
seriously,
thank,
welcome.
We're going to take your time too long. We've got questions to get to, but no, I felt all the support from this room. I really did throughout, and it gave me a lot of strength to keep going. So I'm so grateful for everyone who reached out, and I appreciate it all. And I will say that the briefing room was probably the thing I missed most while I was away, being in here. So I'm glad to be back. I'll pass back to you for the first question.
Oh, no. Well,
quickly, I wanted to know about Sudan. I wonder if there are any more convoys which are planned, if we expect to see any in the coming days.
That's Fox News reporter Ben Hall returning to the State Department following serious injuries he suffered while covering the war in Ukraine. We also heard State Department spokesman Vedant Patel in there and the AP's Matt Lee. You can see the entire briefing at cspan.org. More now from House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's speech in Jerusalem. He is just the second House leader to speak to Israel's parliament, and the first in 25 years. He led a bipartisan group of 20 members of Congress who traveled there to celebrate Israel's 75th anniversary of independence. And his speech highlighted the historic bonds between the U.S. and Israel. He also called out what he thinks is the main threat to peace in the Middle East.
But as we welcome peace, we cannot ignore the threats to peace in our region. Those threats have one primary cause, the rogue Iranian regime. Most of the turmoil in this region of violence and instability can be traced back to that source, which continues to fund terrorism, arms its proxy militias, and pursues nuclear weapons. Iran seeks to destabilize Iraq. It wants to entrench missiles in Syria. It empowers the terrorist organization Hezbollah in Lebanon, and it is fueling a brutal civil war in Yemen. And among all this aggression, it seeks to encircle Israel with hostile forces. We cannot allow Iran regime evil campaign to succeed. To deter Iran's dangerous behavior, our nations must continue to stand together. We, the United States, integrated Israel into our central command and are continuing to carry out military exercises together. As long as I am speaker, America will continue to support fully funding for security assistance in Israel. Together, we will defeat Iran's precision-guided missiles, their drones, their terror tunnels, and cyber attacks. As we stand shoulder to shoulder against Iran's regional aggression, we must always remain resolute in our commitment that Iran will never acquire a nuclear weapon.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy speaking to the Israeli Knesset on Monday. Now, following his speech, the speaker indicated to reporters that he would be willing to invite Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Washington, D.C. if President Biden does not. Now, that remarks comes after the president had previously been critical of the Israeli government and Prime Minister Netanyahu's decision to pursue judicial reforms in the country. That decision had sparked massive protests around the country. You can see the speaker's entire remarks and his press conference at cspan.org. Conservative columnist Bill Kristol said earlier today that he hopes, quote, everyone gets punished who was involved in the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. His remarks came during his keynote speech at the Anti-Defamation League's 2023 National Leadership Summit here in Washington, D.C.
A lot of people criticize the Justice Department, for example, for prosecuting, like, what is it now, 1,000 of the insurrectionists on January 6th, when they haven't yet at least decided whether to prosecute former President Trump or other very senior people who are responsible in some sense, who are responsible for inciting those people, many of whom were sort of duped, you might say, by them or by Tucker Carlson or by others on social media, into being insurrectionists. But I do think it's very important. I hope everyone gets punished all the way up and down the line if they did something illegal, if they did something wrong, but or illegal at least. Can't punish people always for just things that are wrong. But storming the Capitol is more than wrong. It's illegal and dangerous. But I think these punishments have actually had a good effect. You know, why wasn't there violence? Why has there, thankfully, been a little less violence than I think some of us expected in November 22, in the next election, when there were closely contested races in states like Arizona with election deniers? What about Trump coming to New York for the indictment a month ago? I think people are a little bit deterred by the fact that people like them, who believe what they were being told by former presidents or by social media or by a major cable news network, are paying a price for that. You know, there's a reason the rule of law needs to have behind it the threat of just punishment for your actions. So let's hold people accountable at the top and the bottom. But let's get to the people at the top, too, because I think one other problem I have with some of the discussion about the current situation is it focuses so much on let's say the mobs, on the credulous people who believe conspiracy theories, on the people who are incited by demagogues, on the prejudices and bigotry and even hatreds, resentments, anxieties of all the people out there, which the demagogues then take advantage of. But look, this is a huge country. Things change. We have a lot of technological and cultural change. People are going to have anxieties and resentments. And to some degree, there's always going to be prejudice. There's always going to be the potential for real hatred and real cruelty and real violence.
Conservative columnist Bill Kristol speaking earlier today at the Anti-Defamation League Leadership Summit here in Washington, D.C. Also appearing at this event, Susan Rice, President Biden's outgoing domestic policy advisor. She spoke about the rise of anti-Semitism and hate in schools.
As a black woman, I've known all my life what it means to be hated or feared for what I represent or for who I am. I also know the value of allyship in confronting hate. I was raised in the tradition of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney. I know that none of us is safe when any of us is targeted. Washington's Jewish community shaped so much of my upbringing. I grew up in Shepherd Park at the top end of 16th Street, when it was a mixed black and Jewish neighborhood. My family home used to belong to the Israeli embassy, and we kept a mezuzah on our front door frame. I was taught the Shema from my Jewish classmates and welcomed at their homes for seders. I was fortunate to travel with my father and brother to Israel for the first time at age 14 and visit Yad Vashem and Masada and a working kibbutz. And somewhere along the way, I think I learned to nail the whole chutzpah thing. Maybe just a little. Jewish commitments to justice and tikkun olam, repairing the world, have long been sources of inspiration to me. But as this group knows all too well, we still have a lot of tikkun to do when it comes to the dangerous threat of anti-Semitism. Like the president, I take personally anti-Semitism, not only because it targets a community that I consider mishpacha, but because it hurts us all. White, black, Asian, Latino, Native American, evangelical Christian, Muslim and Sikh, rural and urban, Democrat and Republican, disabled, LGBTQI+, and straight. Anti-Semitic incidents, whether online or in person, threaten Jews' sense of safety. Yet all of us are worse off when the Jewish community is intimidated, harassed, and attacked for who they are.
Susan Rice, senior advisor to President Biden, speaking at the Anti-Defamation League's National Leadership Summit on Monday. Other speakers at today's event included Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen of Nevada. You can see the entire event at cspan.org. Finally, we are less than a week away from the official coronation of King Charles III in London. More than 2,200 people, including foreign delegations from 203 countries and about 100 heads of state, have confirmed their attendance for the May 6th coronation service at Westminster Abbey. And here's best-selling author Tina Brown talking about this weekend's ceremonies.
Well, I think I really do think that for Charles, this is the sort of greatest moment of his life, the culmination of everything. It's what he's been put on this earth to do, what he's been waiting all this time for, preparing all this time. And I think he takes it actually as a very sort of sacred moment in his life. He's quite religious. He's a deeply spiritual man at any rate. And certainly views this as a very spiritual for him occasion. The anointing, again, is going to be out of sight as it was for his mother. And that, I think, for Charles is going to be a very sacred moment. So I think that he is going to be
tell us about the anointing? Just because we haven't had a coronation for 70 years. What actually is the anointing?
The anointing is when the archbishop, takes the sacred oils, the holy anointing oils, and daubs the king, on his head, on his chest. The king is wearing at that moment not his sort of regal robes, but his sort of, it's like a shift that they put on. I mean, it's out of sight. It's called the super tunica, which I have to say sounds like some wonderful Karl Lagerfeld thing that we all want, right? Rush out and get your super tunica, everybody. A little Monty Python-y, perhaps. But he will then emerge
I just want to get this. Hold on. I just want to get this absolutely straight. He goes behind some sort of curtain or into some sort of private room.
Yes. Yes, a canopy. Undressed. He'll be on a canopy, obscured from the cameras.
He'll be under a canopy. Okay. Then he gets undressed. He's daubed in sacred oil, and then he's redressed.
Then he's put into the ceremony, the estate robes, which are the robes of the king, the beautiful purple ermine robes of the king, and then he comes out and he's at that moment he's king. And so that's a very, very big deal for Charles. So I think that he's going to be very focused, very centered, and very calm. I think Camilla is going to be, quite honestly, a basket case. I think she is so. This is such a wild development that she's going to be now queen.
Best-selling author Tina Brown talking to Washington Post Live about this weekend's coronation of Britain's King Charles. First Lady Dr. Jill Biden will lead the U.S. delegation to the event. Special Climate Envoy John Kerry, who has worked closely with King Charles on climate initiatives over the years, is expected to be part of the U.S. delegation. We will have coverage of that event on the C-SPAN networks. And you can see all of Tina Brown's comments at cspan.org. And just repeating our story from earlier, Politico and The Washington Post reporting that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the U.S. could default as early as June 1st if Congress doesn't act to raise the debt limit. And this tweet just a few moments ago from NBC News' Kelly O'Donnell saying President Biden is inviting the top congressional leaders, that includes Speaker McCarthy and House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries, also Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, to the White House on May 9th to discuss avoiding U.S. default over the debt ceiling limit. That it's a tweet from Kelly O'Donnell from NBC News. If you missed any part of this program, you can also get it as a podcast. Just go to our podcast page, cspan.org/podcast. You can also find it on the C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington, subscribe to our evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.